Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Dennis Prager Show. Good to be with you, as always. Trying to get a guest on who's written a book that I read recently, very recently, and was just so immersed in, and it is such an important subject that I want to share it with you so that we're not going to be doing news right now. Good. He's on. Excellent. All right. He's in. Are you, sir, Victor Sebastian, British journalist, historian? Are you right now in London or what part of the UK?
I'm in London.
All right. Well, welcome to the Dennis Prager Show in the United States.
Well, thank you very much. You're in California, aren't you?
That's correct. As far, almost as far as I can get from you. That's right.
Right, yes.
Listen, I just want you to know, sir, most of the time I have authors on, I've not had a chance to read their book. It's not possible for interviewers to read every book unless that's all they do, and obviously it's not all I do. However, I did read your book, and by the way, I think you'll find this interesting because I'm sure you're interviewed a great deal. I don't know whether I do a better interview with an author if I did read the book or didn't read the book.
Well, I completely agree with you. Having been a journalist most of my life, I've interviewed lots of people. I knew nothing about them at all, and I think often they were better interviewed.
Yes.
Ask sort of very basic.
Yes, exactly, because then I am in the same place that the listener is in. I'm really representing them. But I did read every word of your book because I couldn't put it down. And the book, let me just tell my listeners, the book is Lenin, The Man, the Dictator, and the Master of Terror. Now, let me tell you why I loved your book. The Brits don't handle compliments very well, so you don't even have to react. But I want to tell you and my listeners why I love your
book. I have a foreign background. I handle compliments very well.
That was good. That was very good. All right. In that case, good. You'll love this. First of all, it met the criterion of interest. You write the book so that when I put it down, I regret having to put it down. It's that interesting. Number two, my field of study was communist affairs. I was at the Russian Institute at Columbia University in my graduate days, studied Russian, and I know Lenin. I mean, I never met him, but I know. I didn't come to this unaware. So your book is even more impressive. For some, even though I knew him, I felt I was meeting him for the first time. So, and one more thing, you have moral passion, and that is not common. You're the very subtitle of your book, Master of Terror, reveals what you believe to be true. So, congratulations! All right.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. That's. I know how to take. I know how to take it on the chin. I can also take criticism, but which I get from time to time. But I'm really glad you enjoyed it, and I only hope many other people will enjoy it too. I write to inform, but I also write to please, and I hope that comes across in the style.
Entirely. So let me just tell my listeners, you make the case, which is entirely in my 100% accurate, that in effect, he started the totalitarian mass murder ball rolling in the 20th century. Is that fair to say?
I think so. And the rest of the 20th century was very much a reaction to what happened in Russia in 1917. It was Lenin who built who started the idea that political terror against opponents was justified for the greater end. It was perfected by people after him, Stalin after him, but the main ideas were Lenin's. So yes, he was the first. He was the first totalitarian.
Now, I want people to know that Lenin's older brother was hanged by the Tsar, and from your book, one gets the impression that had that not happened, Lenin would not have taken the radical road he did. He was apolitical till his brother was hanged.
That's true. He was. I mean, he was only 17, of course.
Right.
But he wasn't at all interested in politics before that. He was radicalized as the new N-word is almost overnight after that. And it wasn't just the fact that his brother was hanged for a political offense. It was that what hurt him and what got to him just as much was what happened to his family was shunned afterwards by sort of polite bourgeois middle class society in the provincial town in which he grew up. They were from being basically, you know, pillars of the establishment in this town. They were absolutely nobodies. Nobody would talk to them. He couldn't even get a game of chess with anyone, you know, after that. When his mother went to St. Petersburg from Simbirsk, which was the town he was born in, to plead for her son Alexander's life, Lenin couldn't find a single person, middle-class person, to go and accompany her on the journey, which was, you know, a long journey. Absolutely everyone refused. It was his hatred of the bourgeois and the liberal establishment after that was absolutely the driving force of Lenin's politics, as much as anything by Marx or Engels or anyone. It was a very emotional reaction that drove him.
I just want to skip forward for a minute for my listeners that recently a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, whom I had on my show, some of my listeners will recall, she wrote a piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's at the University of Pennsylvania, I think I mentioned it, but if not, that's the reason it was the Philadelphia Inquirer, a local newspaper, as it were. And she wrote about how it is a tragedy that we have abandoned bourgeois values. She was attacked by literally half of her fellow professors at the law school at the University of Pennsylvania, which is one of our Ivy League schools. And it made me think that the hatred of the bourgeoisie, this middle class value vanilla, as many would consider it, that really is a frightening thing for civilization.
I wouldn't draw a comparison entirely between Philadelphia or Pennsylvania or wherever in 2018 with Russia in the 1870s to 1880s, actually. But I see your broader point, but I'm not sure that they were the same thing. Remember that Russia, the Russia of Lenin's revolution and of Lenin's politics was not a nice, decent, liberal democracy. It was an authoritarian, brutal state. The Tsar killed and exiled, hundreds of thousands of people for the simple offense of reading the wrong books. So this was not a comparison. Tsarist Russia.
No, I agree.
And middle class America.
I was only right.
They're not the same place.
Oh, entirely correct. Of course, I'm only comparing hatred of the bourgeois to hatred of the bourgeois. Hatred of the Tsar is not hatred of the bourgeoisie.
But the bourgeois of 1870s are not the same.
Okay. Oh, I see. Fine. Now. All right. That's fair. That's fair. But The word is the same.
In my opinion.
I understand. No, that's fair to say. But in light of that, though, let me ask you this. I've always wondered about this, and that is, if there had been no Marxist or Marxist-Leninist Bolshevik revolution in 1917, in fact, had the Tsar never been overthrown in the first Russian Revolution and earlier in February 1917, would Russia have evolved on its own into a more decent place? I'll get your answer when we come back. I got to take a break. We have commercials in America that make radio possible. Victor Sebastian is the author, British journalist, fantastic book, Lenin, The Man, the Dictator, and the Master of Terror, the father of the Russian Revolution. It's 100 years ago. It is appropriate, actually 101 years ago, it is appropriate that we talk about this. If you want to understand the modern world, you must understand Lenin. I'm Dennis Prager. We continue. Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here. You want to understand the 20th century, you want to understand communism, you want to understand Russia, then you need to know about the father of much of that, and that is Lenin. The author of the Bolshevik or Russian or communist or Marxist, whatever you wish to call it, revolution. The second one, actually, and I'll explain that in a moment, but I just read a magnificent biography of Lenin, which holds your interest from the very beginning, and that is by Victor Sebastian, British journalist and historian. And by the way, obviously you didn't need to be told, but I just want to reinforce, I always tell guests, it is quite all right to differ with me. I just want you to know, it is a non-issue, all right?
I did it before I was told it was okay. Is that all right?
I'm sorry, you were told it was okay?
No, I did it before you told me.
Oh, yeah.
It was okay. Is that all right?
Yeah. Yes, maybe you inferred it from my original comments, but I don't. But
I
what?
Did.
Okay, good. I'm glad. And it is a non-issue to me. So, all right. But the book, my friends, is up at DennisPrager.com. The book, this great book on Lenin, and history is my favorite subject. Always was, even as a child, because it's like the ultimate mystery, the ultimate soap opera, the ultimate everything, and you can't know where you are if you don't know where you were. I just don't know why everybody isn't interested in history. All right, so back to my question. Would we all recognize the backwardness morally, economically, socially of Tsarist Russia? Okay, the Russia of the Tsars until 1917. However, if there had not been a Russian Revolution, what do you think would have happened?
It's very unlikely that it would have developed into a nice, cozy democracy of the Western European style democracy. The Tsars, the leadership there, the ruling class there, had absolutely no intention of turning the country that way. They didn't want to go into the 20th century. They still believed they could exist very well back in the 17th century when the Romanov dynasty started its rule. They had to be dragged kicking into even the most minor reforms over censorship, over absolutely anything at all, trial by jury. They had no intention of democratizing in that way. So when you say what might have happened, in my view, one should start from that point of view. Having had the war, which they lost, and we're losing, which was the main reason why the Tsar, one of the main reasons why the Tsar was forced to abdicate in the first of the revolutions that you mentioned in February 1917, was largely because the First World War was a disaster for the Russians, and that was very much of the Tsar's making. They were losing it right from the start. They were holding on by the skin of their teeth. There was mass starvation in Russia as a result of it. Complete dislocation of the countries. So you've got to start from that position before you look forward. There could easily have been they could have got rid of the Tsars and had a military dictatorship of the right was just as likely as a left-wing revolution. But if we think that everything would have developed in a nice liberal democratic way in Russia, I think that's an illusion. Historians have disagreed for the last 100 years or so. Historians have disagreed on this issue, but I think a majority view amongst historians is that it is very unlikely that Russia would have developed along the lines that them.
Right.
That most
All right, so that leads me to another grand question, one that's plagued me since I began my studies of Russian language and culture and society. And I have evolved in a negative direction. My original belief, for much of my life actually, was that you can't blame the Russians for communism because it was a sort of implant from abroad that was foisted on the country, obviously by Russians themselves, but nevertheless a very small minority. Even though Bolshevik means majority, they were in the minority on the left.
Tiny minority.
Right. So the question really is, my question to you, and the one that I have wrestled with is authoritarianism / totalitarianism, non-democracy, non-liberal society endemic to Russian culture? That's my question.
Well, maybe not to the culture, which sort of is separate. The great, great culture, the fantastic writers and great, you know, European tradition of culture, amazing music, amazing art, is in its. I mean, Russia is split between the East. It's half Europe and half Asia. And that has been a split inside, you know, the Russian politics, Russian culture, Russian religion, everything throughout history. So it is not the tradition that we all know about when we read Tolstoy or whoever. We think, oh, you know, in the great European tradition, and that is indeed part of Russia, but just as strong a part is a very eastern traditions that are completely different. So whether of course the idea, even now when this question is asked, you know, because it's drifted to authoritarianism, you know, again in Russia's history, we're always asked, are they destined, or was destined to be that way? And that, of course, is the narrative that the leaders always want. The big strong leader always wants that narrative, that, you know, you cannot run Russia any other way. Just the same way that the communists had that narrative, the Tsars had that narrative. You can quite see why they buy into it. Why do we have to buy into it? I don't know. I think,
well, the only I didn't buy into it. The reason I
I'm not disagreeing. I think it would be a mistake of us to think that it will always ever forever be thus.
No, well, right.
Circumstances can change.
Correct. The problem is, though, until now, and again, I was a defender of Russia for much of my life, of the Russian, I don't know, spirit, if you will, if you don't like the word culture. But now, I mean, you know, with Putin, yeah. after Stalin, and, you know, I'm skipping Khrushchev and Brezhnev, etc., and then with Lenin, and then the Tsars, the track record is awful. The book is Lenin, and it's magnificent, and it's up at DennisPrager.com. Hello, everybody. Dennis Prager here, trying to understand the world every day. It's hard to understand it if we don't understand communism, Russia, totalitarianism, political terror, you name it. One way to do it is to begin with the beginning, and that is with Lenin, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, originally Vladimir Ulyanov. Then the book to do it with is just out. And I read every word of it. Victor Sebastian, British journalist and historian. The book is Lenin, The Man, the Dictator, and the Master of Terror. And we are discussing right now Russia itself. And I said that I've made a pessimistic turn in my view of Russia, thinking that communism was an implant, and now when I look at it, went from Tsar to Lenin to Stalin to Putin. It's, as I said at the very end before our break, the track record of Russia is not admirable. So that's my case. Would you like to respond?
Oh, well, I'd agree. It's the track record hasn't been admirable, but one can't, in my view, just sort of give up hope and say, well, that's Russia. There's nothing you can do about it. One just has to. There surely are ways and to try and understand why leadership does the things that it do. Circumstances have always been against the people. The people have never had in Russia have never been allowed any choices, any power at all. The moment they had a chance, they got rid of communism. The moment they had the manner in which they got rid of which they killed off communism in a peaceful way, considering the extraordinary violence with which it existed for seven 70 years, was something very much to admire. I'd have thought the fact that this country has been stolen again since is tragic. But
they elect him. They do elect him.
They do elect him.
Okay, that's important.
They do. And maybe he is popular. And I think they probably. I'm not sure entirely how fair those elections are. There's no opposition allowed.
Right. No, I agree with that. Okay.
The democracy is more than just votes. It's the way that there's no civil society, there's no separation of powers, there's no free, there is no democracy. All you have is manipulated votes every 5 years is in itself not a democratic process. It requires more than that, and it requires strong.
All right, so I want to. I would like.
I think it's true. He is probably popular, and partly it's because they remember chaos. You know, the Russians have had chaos a lot, and they fear chaos. And that one strong man comes along and says,
"Right,
I can guarantee there's no chaos."
Right.
It's sort of understandable. It's sad.
Oh, well, right. Okay. Whether it's understandable or not. All right. Look, I don't have an axe to grind because
Nor do I.
Let me ask you this.
I find it hard to be optimistic
about
the future of Russia.
Okay.
I find it very hard.
Victor, let me ask you a question.
Knowing its history and knowing its present.
All right.
I find it very hard.
Right.
I do look at the way they got rid of communism, and that is a holding out a hopeful
all right.
thing.
Question for you then. What percentage, and obviously it's a guess, but for you it's a truly educated guess, what percentage of Russians have an admirable or admiring view of Lenin?
I would say the older people probably have more of an admiring view of Lenin. Because he was so much, he was with them so much. Even though he died in 1924, the cult of Lenin had been so powerful in the Soviet Union, and it sort of justified a great deal of what Stalin did, justified a lot of things what Stalin's successors did too. They have a much higher opinion of Stalin, just depressingly, than they do of Lenin. And that is deliberately manipulated by the leadership now.
Well, that hold it there. I got to take a break. But that if that's not scary, I don't know what is. The book is Lenin. It is up at DennisPrager.com. God, I once knew the Russian words to this.
Oh.
I'm speaking, my friends, to Victor Sebastian, who's a British journalist and historian. His new book is Lenin, The Man, The Dictator, and The Master of Terror. It's a fantastic book. It is up at DennisPrager.com. So, forgetting optimism or pessimism, I was not thinking in those terms. I was just thinking in an assessment of Russia as it has been for really pretty much all of its organized history. It has not been morally, socially admirable. And this is, I say it with sadness because I love Russian culture. I love Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and the whole crowd, and learned Russian because I love the language. But when you just said right before the break here that Stalin is even more popular than Lenin, even for me, that's difficult to believe, but I believe you. Stalin, I just want to state, you know, the big picture. Stalin murdered at least 20 million of their fellow citizens, was the author single-handedly of the terror famine that killed at least 4 million Ukrainians, and that man is admired.
He's very much admired by Putin. And even
I thought you meant admired by the Russian people.
In textbooks that are in Russian schools now, he's referred to, and I quote this, as a great Russian national leader, close quote. He's very, very much in the nationalists around Putin and in that entourage. He is held up as a, you know, to them, modern Russian history didn't start in 1917. It started in 1945 with essentially victory in the Second World War, with a big extension of the Russian Empire throughout large part right up to Western Europe. All the gains of Tsarism, but even more. He's held up as a, and there, in some places there is, you know, there are statues going up into, they haven't destroyed them all. He is considered, in the continuum of Russian leaders, one of the great Russian leaders by Putin. It's terrifying. It's ghastly. It's horrible. But this is the truth. Putin had a problem with how to celebrate or not celebrate, to mark the 100th anniversary of the revolution a couple of months back. And in fact, while there were big exhibitions about the revolution in Britain, in London, where I am now, there were two really very good ones. There were exhibitions in Germany. There were lots of TV programs and radio things about the revolution. In Russia, there was hardly anything at all. Quite deliberately done by Putin, directly. Because it wouldn't send a great message to the people that you can get rid of a corrupt and autocratic leader by the will of the people, or even by a small coup of troublemakers. And it was a difficult, Putin hates the word revolution. He doesn't particularly like the word communist. You can write out in Stalin's history, you can almost write out the fact that he was a communist. You can't do that with Lenin, and they do revere him. He was the tough leader. They do say, oh yes, you know, he was strong, and you know, they don't completely write out the fact that there were millions of deaths. But it's a small little side clause in a paragraph of a pen of praise to him.
All right. Well,
very depressing. Beyond depressing.
Okay, it is beyond depressing. That's exactly right. Back to Lenin. Another interesting thing. I have always felt this, and I think your book corroborates this. Lenin was, look, you call him Master of Terror, and that's right, he was. And he as easily sent opponents to die as I eat lunch. So, but here's the interesting thing, and the reason I raise it. in his personal life, he was a, one might even say, an upright individual. Is that fair to say?
Yes, he was. He wasn't personally, he wasn't, I know this sounds like a, paradox, but, you know, Lenin thought of himself, and lots of people, you know, as an idealist, well, lots of brutal people do that, but he wasn't a monster or a sadist or vicious, and in personal relationships, he was invariably kind and behaved in the way he was brought up.
And like had only one mistress.
A middle-class gentleman. He wasn't vain, and he could even laugh at himself something. He didn't wear uniforms like Stalin, you know, Mao Zedong, or, you know, Mao Zedong, or Hitler. He never asked about the details of his victims' deaths and savoring the moment like some of these other dictators did. To him, the deaths were largely theoretical, and you know they were mere numbers, or they were mere pieces on a chessboard. He knew what was happening, of course, because he used the word shoot. One of the great things that shocked me, and when I was researching this book, I mean, I knew that he had sent people, he had started the whole process of the gulags and created the what became the KGB and all that. I knew all that, but when you see it in his own handwriting, and when you see the cables, you know, coming, you're almost as though he dictated them from his own mouth. It's completely different. But to him, he was always looking at a greater end. So that's what I said, that the death,
the greater end, yeah. Is he the one who said to make omelets you have to break eggs?
Well, it's not, he didn't say it quite like that.
But he lived it, but I know, yes.
That's absolutely an exact...
Final question.
What he thought.
All right, I'll do the final question when we come back. The book is Lenin. It is up at my website. All right, everybody. I want to end with some thoughts of my own, but first I just want to ask the author, Victor Sebastian in London, what are you now working on? What book?
I've just signed a deal. It's a biography, but not of a person, of a city, which is the city of my birth, Budapest. I've literally just signed that yesterday, so fresh, hot off the press.
Wait, I'm sorry, you did a book on Budapest?
I'm about to do a history of Budapest.
Oh, I see, okay, fine.
A biography of the city of Budapest, which is the city of my birth. And it's quite a relevant thing. I've wanted to do it for a while. So that's what I'm going to be doing.
Well,
having written three, four books now, basically where communism is one of the main issue, I can't say I'm tired of it. It's also of abiding interest, but I find I've got sort of less to say about it.
No, makes perfect sense.
Having done the beginning of the Cold War, the end of the Cold War, and at one point in the middle of the Cold War, I don't really want to do the Cold War anyway. Although, obviously, communism plays a major part in the last part of Budapest.
Yes,
it's only a small. It's not the whole history.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program. I really enjoyed it, and thank you so much for saying all those delightful, nice things about my book. I really am pleased you enjoyed it, and you appreciated it.
Very much so. Thank you again. The book is Lenin. People should read it. People need to understand what it's been like. I just want to emphasize one thing, my dear listeners. The ignorance of communism is a passion of mine. Everybody knows about Nazism, and almost nobody knows about communism. It's because people don't care about evil. It's the worst revelation of my life. When I was young, I never thought that people would be as blasé about evil as I have come to believe they are. I mean, there are restaurants named Mao. Man killed 60 million of his fellow Chinese. Not to mention robbed them of a life. Be that as it may, this is the world in which we live, and I try to make it clear on the Dennis Prager Show, to which you are listening. Hello, everybody. I'm Dennis Prager, and this is the Ultimate Issues Hour. The third hour every Tuesday is devoted to a great subject. Not, well, it could be political. There are some great issues in the political realm, but not usually. The moral, the philosophical, the religious, the personal. I mean, the stuff that's bigger than our immediate issues in life, which are very important. I live them as you live them. Taking care of a family, taking care of your health, marital problems, financial problems, health problems. I'm well aware of all of them, and they're ubiquitous. But what happens is it's hard then to concentrate ever on the really big stuff. But the big stuff is big stuff for a good reason. Well, there's nothing bigger than this one. Is there an afterlife? Is it amazing to me that people don't, well, I think people do think about it, but what is amazing to me is the way it is dismissed and done with mockery. There are three right now. Today is Tuesday. Every Monday we come out with a course at Prager University, okay? I give a very small percentage of the courses. I give maybe 15%. I think less, maybe 10%. I would say 1 out of 10. Let me think. There are 300. Have I given? I haven't given 30, have I? I don't think so. I give fewer than 10%. But I give this one on the afterlife. It's 5 minutes, like all the courses at Prager University. There are 3,000 on YouTube. There are 3,037 comments in the first day. Most of them are mocking me. 844,000 views. Yeah, I hope it'll reach many millions of people. But the point is, I want to talk to you about the reactions. I'm going to play for you the video, and then I'm going to read some of the reactions, and you will see some very interesting trends. One is that a lot of Americans don't know how to think clearly. They react to me, but they don't react to what I said. And that, I don't care if people differ. It really, it's a non-issue to me. But it's really scary if you say that, can I think of an analogy? I like oranges because of their taste. And then people will say, you know why Prager says oranges are good? Because they're orange. But that's not what I, that was not my argument. So here is the beginning of the, we'll see how much I play of it, of the video, Is There Life After Life? After this life, right. Is there life after this life?
Is there an afterlife? Life after this life ends? There probably isn't a human being who hasn't asked this question at one time or another. And here's the answer. If there is a God, there is an afterlife. It's that simple. And here's why. First, this life is filled with an immeasurable amount of injustice and suffering. The only way there can be some ultimate justice for victims of evil is if there is an afterlife. And the only way comfort is available to those who suffer unjustly, from painful disease and premature death to the death of a child, is if there is an afterlife. But such an afterlife exists only if there is a good and just God.
All right, let's stop it there. God. Okay, so the argument, I never argue that there is an afterlife, period. It's all based on an if. But nobody responds to the if. If you really need to read the comments. I'm as interested that you read the comments attacking me as I am your viewing the video to understand how poorly so many Americans think, and especially those who have antipathy to any religious belief. They think they're the rational ones. It's a frightening thing, actually, to read it, because they're certain that they're rational and I'm not rational. But my entire video, all 5 minutes, is rational. It says if there is a good God, then there is an afterlife. If there's no good God, then there is no afterlife. I don't know why that's even arguable. You can say, all right, he's right. If there is a good God, there is an afterlife. But there is no God, so there's no afterlife. That's fine. That is the most logical response if you don't believe in an afterlife. Well, Prager's premise that there is a good God, just it's unfortunate, but there isn't one. Either there is a God who is not good, or there's no God at all. Fine. I didn't read, I'm sure somebody must have said it, but I didn't read one response that said that. They all say Prager believes in an afterlife because he really wants ultimate justice, or because he's pained by all the injustice. Well, so what? But I never said that. I didn't say there's an afterlife because there's injustice. So there's an afterlife because there's a good God, if there is a good God. I didn't even say because. I said if. It's one day it dawns upon a thinking American that the people who pride themselves in reason are the least rational. This is a perfect example. Go on, please.
Second, since God is not physical, the physical world is not the only reality. There is also a non-physical reality. And we humans have a part of us which, being non-physical, survives the death of our body. We call it the soul. But if there is no God, this physical life is all there is.
Okay.
So, no God, no soul, no soul, no afterlife.
Right. What's the argument against that? There is no argument. The only argument is, well, I don't believe there's a God. Fine. Okay. Agreed. Then we agree. If there is a God, then there is a soul, and then there is an afterlife. If there is no God, there is no soul. All we are is stellar matter. You and I are just physical creatures like a mountain. We only differ, the only difference between us and a mountain or a river or a star is that we are self-aware and they are not. That's it. But we are just stellar matter. Now, if you believe that, fine. Then you clearly don't believe there's no possibility of an afterlife because there's nothing non-physical that exists. Okay, that's fair. My arguments are not attackable because they're based on an if. Now, you can say the if doesn't exist. That's fine. Then that ends our discussion. I agree. All right, go on, please.
Now, of course, those who doubt God's existence have every reason to doubt an afterlife.
See?
But if you believe in a good God, then you have to believe there's an afterlife. If you say you believe in God but not in an afterlife, the God you believe in is not only not good, that God is cruel. That God made a world filled with unjust suffering and just left it at that. Now, some people who don't believe in an afterlife offer their own version of immortality. I once attended a funeral where the man officiating said, "While there is no afterlife, we do live on through our good works and in the memories of loved ones." That's what a lot of people who reject an afterlife want to believe. But the idea that human beings live on through their good works or through the memories of loved ones, which generally means a person's children or grandchildren, is simply meaningless. If people live on through their good works, then children who die don't live on. The number of good works most children are even capable of is minuscule. As for babies who die, well, babies can't engage in good works at all, so I guess they just don't live on.
All right, we'll stop there, and we will be back in a moment. This is the Ultimate Issues Hour. This video is the latest at Prager University. It's the comments on it that really are the substance of this hour. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. Hello, my friends. The Ultimate Issues Hour on The Dennis Prager Show, the third hour on Tuesdays. Yesterday, the Prager University video comes out every Monday. The one is given by me, and it is, Is There Life After This Life? My argument I've been playing for you is quite simple, not simplistic. If there is a good God, then there is an afterlife. If there isn't a good God, there isn't any. I think it's 100% unassailable. Whether you believe in God or not, the argument is an if argument. That's it. If there is a road, you can drive to this destination. If there is no road, you can't. If it's 0 degrees out, you need to wear a coat. Now, if it's not 0 degrees out, if it's 80 degrees out, then you don't need to wear a coat. An if proposition is either true or not true. Whether the condition upon which the if is based exists is a separate question entirely. I didn't say there is a good God, and therefore there's no question that there is an afterlife. I said if there is a good God. The inability of people to perceive that in the comments, and you can see it all on YouTube until they put us, maybe they'll put this on the restricted list, we don't know. They have 40 of the PragerU videos on restricted list. You know, real pornographic ones like A History of the Korean War. It's disgraceful, but that's a separate issue. Well, that's great. I am speaking to two people at all times in my mind. Those who agree with me and those who don't agree with me. To those who agree with me, I am giving what I call intellectual ammunition. To those who disagree with me, I am hopefully giving reason to reconsider their views. And I consider both audiences equally important, because the people who agree with me need the intellectual ammunition. And it's always helpful to have one's faith strengthened, political faith or religious faith. But that is the case. And the point that he just mentioned, Gary in New Jersey, of Manalapan, New Jersey, I might add, is a very big one. And I'm glad it made the impact it should on him. If there is no God, the only difference between you and a rock is that you have self-awareness. That's it. You are made of the same stuff. The rock has no soul. You have no soul. The rock erodes. You erode. If anything, the rock is here a hell of a lot longer than you are. And that's it. People don't like to confront the consequences of a godless universe. But it needs to be confronted. This is it. It's all a coincidence. It's all meaningless. And when you die, back to the afterlife issue, when you die, that's it. And that's it means that all the people that you've bonded with, it's it for eternity. You will never see them again. And that's it. Just people, people accept that. But it's important to realize it. I was trying to be unassailable. I was trying to make an argument that you can't deny. If I say I, Dennis, believe in a God and therefore believe in an afterlife, then it's easily argued with. Well, who cares what one guy believes in? For all we care, the guy could believe in a turtle. It doesn't matter. But here, the argument can't be assailed. It is an ironclad argument. If God is good, there's an afterlife. So now that forces everyone watching to think, well, do I believe there is a good God in the universe? And a lot of people do, and then they don't realize, well, then that argues inexorably for an afterlife. I'm not trying to be ecumenical. I am trying to be persuasive.
Right. And it occurs to me, even as I'm asking it, the format that you chose, even if people disagree with it, it encourages them to think about the question.
You got it, my friend. That is exactly right. That's why one of my books is titled Think a Second Time. I want people to start thinking because they stop thinking at college. I promise you, I mean this literally, college teaches you how not to think. If you graduate college thinking clearly, it is because you didn't take your classes seriously or you didn't take your professor seriously. In most cases, there are always exceptions. I understand that. I think that God judges us because he loves us. There is no... You can't love without judging. If God loved everybody... Well, because that then leads to the other question, which I should do another Ultimate Issues Hour on. I think I will thank you for it, Cameron. Is, does God love everyone equally? And I know a lot of people say yes, because they believe in unconditional love. I have discussed the issue of unconditional love. I don't see any basis for it in logic or in the Bible. No matter how you act, I love you the same is a very strange notion to me. It's foreign to my understanding of God, of justice, of love. It would mean that the only thing that we do not link to morality is love. This would be an odd thing to do. Oh, boy. Alejandro in Burbank and Zipporah in L.A. and Barton, Walla Walla, Washington. Priscilla in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Rosemary in Evanston, Illinois. Steve in Los Angeles and Wendell in Atlanta. I wish I could take your calls. I'm smiling because I really need it. Anyway, take a look at the video and don't forget, look at the thousands of comments. And then you can weep at what college education has done to prevent clear thought in so many. All right, my friends. Thank you for being with me. I'll see you tomorrow. I'm Dennis Prager. Thanks again.